Hi, folks, it's Henry here, just popping in at the start to let you know we had a little bit of a microphone mix-up on the recording of this, so it might sound a little bit off, just a little more echoey, but I think it's still pretty fine, but if you think there's something like, oh, this feels a little off, that's why. Anyway, apologies for that, but here is May's talk to the audience.
I heartily endorse this event or product.
Everybody, welcome to Talk to the Audience, where this is always hell. I am your host for this, of course, Bob Mackey, and who else is here with me today?
Henry Gilbert, and I'd just like to say R.I.P. Charles Grodin.
Yes, he's not dead, but he's dead to me.
His career is.
Exactly. You call that living. So yes, again, this is our monthly community podcast. If you're new to this whole Talking Simpsons Patreon, welcome, but every month we do a community podcast where we talk about news in Simpsons and Simpsons-related worlds, and we also talk about your comments that you leave on our Patreon for various episodes in our network. So that's what we'll be doing in this community podcast. But first, there is some news we want to go over, and one of the biggest pieces of news is that we all knew about Disenchantment, the new Matt Groening series. We all knew that Bill Oakley is working on it. We all know that Josh Weinstein is, I believe, co-showrunning it with Ken Keeler,
yes,
or something like
or
that.
Or just showrunner. I think he is at the top, and Bill Oakley is a co-exec.
He's a huge cheese. But finally, we saw images of the three main characters, and if you can believe it, they look like Matt Groening drawings.
Yes, seeing these images now, it's fun to look back on our second interview with Bill Oakley when he was like, I can't say anything. Netflix has a gun to my head, right? He didn't exactly say that, but he talked about how little they were allowed to say about it. But he basically talked around, it looks like a Matt Groening show. And it does, which it should. I would be disappointed if a Matt Groening show didn't look like a Matt Groening show.
I mean, of course it has to. I mean, Matt Groening has a very distinct drawing style. And of course, his designs are cleaned up by animators to make them like movable in a world. But what I like about the Disenchantment characters is that little demon guy is a straight up Matt Groening drawing. Right out of life in hell or something like that. It's just everything else looks like a Simpsons animated world creature, but that little demon is like, it's totally a Matt Groening thing, like Nibbler.
Yeah, and that the trick to him, I think, might be that he's always flat, that he is not, and that sounds like a fun thing to see animated. And this also breaks the five finger rule, like the lead character on the show has five fingers.
Oh my God, I didn't notice that at all. I didn't see any outrage over that. I did see some outrage about the little goblin character.
Yes.
People are calling him Bart. I mean, in that style, there are only so many faces you can draw and only so many heads, but I feel like they're all pretty distinct. And I like how the female character is not like a Leela style babe. She's got rough around the edges, you know?
I think they're not as horned up as the Futurama staff was back in 99. I would agree with some folks that the dwarf character looks a little, as the French would say, Bartesque. But it's the art style, man. That's just how it goes. But I really look forward to the show. They released the first images, but no trailer. But the show is August 17th, so less than 3 months away.
I imagine we'll see some footage before the next Talk to the Audience, probably like a teaser at least, or like a joke.
Were I to imagine myself as a Netflix PR person about when I would release that trailer, I would do it during San Diego Comic-Con in July.
Ooh.
Because you'd be like, all you fucking nerds love this shit, don't you? It's Simpsons, but with Game of Thrones. Just lap it up.
Oh, that's perfect. It's going to happen then, you're right. So we have a bit of sports-related news. I refuse to talk about sports. So Henry, you handle this.
So apparently the Stanley Cup playoffs are going to be in Las Vegas this year, which somebody pointed out that the Stanley Cup appears in the hotel suite in Viva Ned Vegas. So this is Simpsons predicting the future thing, which honestly is a bit of a stretch, but I felt like mentioning it because it was written up on several stories.
I saw that too, and I didn't think that implied that the Stanley Cup was in Vegas or is like a team from Vegas had won it. I just assume like in their drunken craziness they somehow encountered the Stanley Cup and stole it somehow. Like maybe there was a hockey player playing in Vegas or something. I don't know.
Homer magically could steal anything in their Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas style white wine spritzer bin.
I'm looking forward to getting to that. Outside of the thing that Ned Flanders is 60, I enjoy that episode.
I don't love that he's 60. That doesn't, it messes with my personal timeline, but I do love that it then cuts to him driving his Geo, which sounds like a wind-up toy, and then like some water on the side for dipping. That's funny.
Geo is the lasting lore of Flanders. I can't. It's a Geo. So more news, and this is not fun news, but we are now in the 20th anniversary of the passing of Phil Hartman, and it is very sad. We just did recently Fish Called Selma, the recording of it, and it's out. It's out on Patreon, it's out, yeah. And it's out on the main feed probably too. I forget. We are doing so many things, I forget when they actually launch, but man, I mean, we talked about it on A Fish Called Selma, and I'm not saying anything original here, but what a loss. And I can't imagine the awesome things he could have done, how he would have been as Zap Brannigan if he would have made the Troy McClure live action thing. I mean, I feel like, again, he was in his 50s, but like he'd only be 70 something now. Mm. And he was a very young 50 something year old man.
And he had a clean living lifestyle by the sounds of it too, or at least as far as Hollywood goes. And it's a bummer. I mean, if you want to be really depressed about it, to think of the things you didn't get to see. Okay, so you know how every single fucking star from the 90s does a funny thing with Funny or Die with what they did in the 90s?
Yeah.
Think of all the shit he would have done. He would have played live action Troy McClure in like 18 YouTube videos by now, at the very least, even if they never made the movie. Like, God damn it.
We are creeping up on the final Troy. It's coming soon. It'll probably be on our network in a year with Bart the Mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, and it definitely... How can it not hurt the show? Like it can't not damage the show to lose. And you can't recast Phil Hartman.
Yeah, I believe that we even asked Mike Scully that. He said the same thing. Like, yes, of course, like it was a huge loss. And again, it's like all of the characters they wrote to replace him were just not the same. And I think they eventually got rid of those devices.
Yeah.
Just because you need Phil Hartman. Like he was the texture of all of those educational shorts.
And when you take that tool out of the toolbox, it kind of hurts the show. It does damage it in ways you can't expect. RIP Phil Hartman. The world misses you quite a lot.
And so on the brighter side of things, this is my newscasting experience kicking in. We have another live show. Woo! And it's pretty far down the road, but it's July 28th at the Piano Fight Bar in San Francisco. It'll be at 5:30 p.m. on July 28th. Topic to be announced, but it's going to be like 12 Super Bowls.
Yes.
I don't want to get your hopes
10.
Up. Yeah, even better than 10. But move over, Gabbo. We love doing live shows. This will be our fourth one, and I'm super confident it'll be a great time. Come on out. Piano Fight is a great venue. They're super laid back, and the crowd is always great for us. So looking forward to it.
Really cool working with the folks who work there too to set this up, and they've been really just giving with it too. And yeah, if you don't live in the Bay Area or you want to know how like easy it is to get to it, it's right on the BART line, like the mass transit thing. So it's pretty easy to get to just via BART. And yeah, I do think you should fly to San Francisco, even if it's halfway around the world, just to see this.
Like, we will talk to you for 5 minutes in person.
But no, I mean,
over there
it'll be fun. But that's not the speaking of trips in July.
Oh yeah, so now it's totally booked, or it's halfway booked at least. We are going to July. We're going to LA in July for a fun trip. Thanks to all of our awesome people on Patreon, we are able to take these opportunities. We're going to go to Simpsons. Is it called Simpsons World?
I believe yes.
Yeah.
It's the Simpsons ride in Springfield within Universal Hollywood. Which, as listeners may know, I've been to the one in Orlando. Never been to Hollywood, which is a bigger one than the Orlando one. And Bob's never been to either.
Yes. I mean, I've been to Universal Studios. Wait, is this at Universal Studios?
Yes.
Okay, boy, I need to do some research. But yes, I've been to Universal Studios in California, but that was in 1999. So I imagine a lot has changed.
Oh, quite a bit. They replace rides way more often at Universal than they do at Disney. And that's for good or for ill, especially if you're a Minions fan, then it's very good. You're like, yay, more Minions.
Can I still ride the Backdraft ride, which is just a very hot room where things fall over?
No, that's not there anymore.
Damn it.
And I think I'm looking forward to the Fast and Furious ride, which replaced Jaws. Mm-hmm. Like, it basically lets you know when a film from your childhood is obviously no longer popular. And I think we got to move fast to get on that Mummy ride, because that's got to be going soon.
Oh,
it's a great ride, though.
The new Mummy didn't take.
Nope.
So, yes.
So maybe it'll be keeping longer. And And the Harry Potter rides are fun too, but the Simpsons ride is a good ride, but the Springfield is, that's the real draw.
Yeah, we'll do a whole podcast about our experience there. We're also going to be podcasting with a lot of great big names. One we can name is the Everything's Coming Up Simpsons podcast.
Yeah.
And who reached out to us, and that's how this entire trip came into being. We're like, yeah, let's go to LA and let's see who else we can get, and we're going to be doing a lot of recording there. So yeah, it's going to be a good time.
We've got some stuff already bubbling up, but yeah, a special thanks to Allie and Julia for setting this up and reaching out to us because we enjoy that other podcast. Now Simpsons podcasters got to stick together like waffles.
Yeah, but only us two. Everyone else can go to hell.
Yeah, no, go to hell, go to hell.
Yeah,
I'm on a quote binge here, but yeah, I don't know. You finally arrive as a podcaster when you podcast in LA, the mecca of podcasting.
I don't want to live there, but I'll go there to podcast a lot. Come on, people, move to the Bay Area so I don't have to buy a car or drive a car.
Yeah.
It'll work out for me in the end. Let's get to the comments. So we have some for Bart the Fink, and Andrew Giacchetti says, I'll link to the clip and fill out this comment more when I get to the office, but I say the avoidian bit, I think, is another reference to the infamous Shatner, don't tell me how to do the line, it sickens me bit, where Shatner yells at the director on an episode of Star Trek, I believe the animated series, right, for correcting his read. They make a similar joke with the Zap Brannigan doll on Futurama. Bart also says, don't tell me how to do the line, it sickens me.
Yeah, and it's in the show, in the sweet home dum diddly dum doodly, Bart says, it sickens me in the same way Shatner does. I do think it's still dorks just saying, like, avoidian is an evasion, it's a different thing, but...
Yeah, I know I'm sure the it sickens me thing is from the Shatner tapes.
Oh, yeah.
Because so much comedy came out of these tapes that were passed around that only you found out about in the internet age. But I believe the evasion thing was actually came from an argument in the writer's room between Harvard nerds. Nope. That was on the commentary, I believe.
Yeah, though I could see Harry Shearer going to the William Shatner well for this.
Sure.
Spock, sabotage the system. Spock, restore the atmosphere. Spock, sabotage the system. I wish I knew what to do. Observations, Mr. Spock.
Okay, we have line 193 again with sabotage, can I sabotage?
I don't say sabotage. You say sabotage. I say sabotage.
And then it cuts to a live action clip where he does say sabotage on the series. So,
yeah. And then another character says sabotage.
Yeah. And he doesn't get it.
So Maverick 45 says, hey guys, great show as always. I was wondering if you noticed while the family was at IRS Burger, there's a sort of a sign gag. The trash bins are sorted by gross and net, which makes sense as a tax joke. Very simply put, gross is the income before taxes and net is income after taxes. However, the gross bin has some sort of greenish slime coming out of it, perhaps just garbage or perhaps something worse than like puke, while the net bin is relatively cleaner, making the gross bin extra gross as in disgusting. I thought it was a clever pun.
Like football in the groin, it works on so many levels. Thank you for pointing that out. I think I love when people leave comments. A lot of these things I feel like are kind of like don't need to be explained, but I don't think a lot of people really actually know what gross and net stuff is.
Yeah.
So
honestly, I had missed that sign gag too of gross and net, so I like that gag too.
I do love the very blue, bland interior of the IRS burger.
The hell of IRS burger.
So Luke Batty says, in response to what Henry said about tacos in Japan, it's totally true. I live there and it's the food I miss the most. It's become extremely easy to find pizza and burgers, but tacos still have eluded Japan to this day. Unless I'm in Tokyo, I have a hard time finding actual taco restaurants. And since that's probably where Henry was, imagine how I feel. And that is true, although I was in Tokyo and I did see two Mexican restaurants when I was there.
Okay, all right. Maybe it's spreading out a bit more. But
yeah.
I wanted to include that one because several other people are like, really? You can't find a taco in Tokyo? Really?
A taco in Tokyo. By the way, I want to tell people I did go to Japan and we are doing an entire podcast about One Piece for patrons, and that'll include all of my fun Japan stories that are animation related, so that'll be coming up on Patreon very soon, but it's all going to be segregated to that podcast alone. So if you're into anime and Japan and One Piece, it'll all be there with a very special guest.
I've been waiting to hear these stories from Bob.
I've told them to everyone six times except the listeners.
So Lisa the Iconoclast comments, the first one also from Luke Batty. Shame on you, Bob, for switching from saying pop to soda. When I used to occasionally work in craft services on video productions in Iowa, I'd always label the drink cooler pop to rile up the large number of Californians who'd always be there.
I don't know why. I mean, I just felt shame, like as if saying pop made me a hick or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Soda pop.
Now, when I moved to Florida, I did my best to bury my very fey Southern accent, and it led me to have a monotone that I actually don't prefer to a fey Southern accent.
You do a good job, Henry. It never leaks through, I swear.
Oh, well, gosh. Thanks.
If you're from the goofy district of Florida, let's go on to Maverick 45 says, the Kentuckians joke isn't really that deep. If you didn't want to fight for either side of the Revolutionary War, there weren't many places you could escape to except for the West. Pioneers had just recently crossed the Cumberland Gap a decade or two prior, so there was plenty of untouched wilderness west of the Appalachians. Plenty of indigenous people, though, too, so you took your chances. They could have just as easily said Tennesseans, but I think Kentuckians sounds funnier. It does. I'm currently reading a biography on Daniel Boone, who really didn't give two shits about the war. Haha. Most pioneer folk west of the Apps were not concerned with city living and government troubles. So yeah, thank you, yes, and I believe it's all just if Kentuckians is fun.
Yeah. Kentuckians.
We called them Kentuckians.
It's very staccato. It's good. But I did ask for an explanation on Kentuckians. And so thank you, Maverick, for coming through on that. Tony King says, as a Brit, I was unaware that Long John Silver's was a real restaurant. I always, until listening to the episode of this podcast, thought that this was simply a joke. The idea that it's real somehow makes it funnier.
A pirate? yeah. Isn't he one of yours? Is he from the UK?
If he's real,
like, he could be fake. I don't know.
I mean, if it's a pirate, they have a ship, they're usually sailing from the UK to here.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't the other way around. But I guess maybe that's why, because he's more of a historical figure in Britain. So they're just like, well, we can't name a restaurant after this guy. No way.
I'm more of an Arthur Treacher man, as I pointed out before. So Joe Quigley says, coming in with a teacher perspective again on the conversation about how you teach colonial America with all the warts of slavery. While I know that there are a lot of shitty school books in our country that try to whitewash history, I'm lefty McEast Coast O elitist teaching mostly black and brown kids in Brooklyn. So I don't have anyone down my throat to make our founders look good. The main thing is not teaching it is a wart at all. Slavery is so baked into early US history, it's hard to go long without touching on it. The problem I have run into is that it's hard for kids to engage with people once they find out they're slave owners. It's tricky to get kids to move beyond Jefferson being a slave-owning racist and probable rapist to actually focus on his political ideals and actions, which are also really, really important to understand U.S. history, despite the hypocrisy of the man generating them. It's hard. I'll admit it is fun when they get all hyped to love Hamilton because he's Jefferson's enemy, only to hear Jefferson champion the poor and Hamilton's elegant writing about how poor people suck. It's a good lesson in history, rarely having good guys. I mean, yeah, people are complicated. I hate having to start a sentence this way, but I'm not defending Nazis, but people who, enacted genocides and horrible war atrocities were also listening to opera and reading philosophy and living upper-class lives.
Nazis were some of the most cultured people around, at least at the higher levels. So.
And they were all horrible monsters.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things of just like, oh, well, art changes people. It's like, not all of them.
It's true.
Some people. Like, America is a land of contrasts.
It is.
But now I do wonder, I liked that insight from a teacher, too, of just like, well, Jefferson did like the poor. As long as you were white, he's assuming Jefferson was thinking of white poor people.
I mean, I only like to make fun of founding fathers to annoy people who are like worshiping them. So I usually say, like, I don't care about a guy who didn't wash his dick more than once a week. Why should I trust him?
On to Homer the Smithers comments here. Maverick 45 again, who's a real MVP of comments this month, says, here are some fun Taft facts, now going more into U.S. history. He didn't get stuck in a tub, but Henry was correct when he said they installed a new, larger one for him. He was the last president with facial hair. He enjoyed his time on the Supreme Court much more than being president. He was the first president to give a first pitch at a baseball game. A news reporter once joked that he was larger than the Wright brothers' plane.
Wow. That's mean.
Yeah, that's mean. This lying media with their fake news about the size of President Taft, they need to back off.
I looked it up and he was 350 pounds, which I don't know where that information came from, but it's out there.
It's definitely bigger than our current president's reported weight.
34 pounds. Yeah. I mean, I don't like fat shaming, but I do think it's fun to make fun of vanity from a horrible man. And the amount, the sheer amount of fabric that Trump like hides in, so you never know his true body shape.
Yeah,
that's not like
on that vanity is funny. It's not like saying like, "Hey, fatso." It's saying like, "Wow, you're so vain. You probably think the end of the world is about you."
I mean, he is an old man covered in like paint and like just draped with fabric, so we never see his actual old man body. But on the record, I believe the fake doctor report was he's 8 feet tall and 239 pounds, and he'll live forever. But no way is he 239 pounds. That was Homer's weight in Brush with Greatness, right?
Yeah, that's
I'm a
right.
whale.
Well, that's when he gets down to. He celebrates getting down to 239.
239, and I'm feeling fine. Mm. That's right. So let's move on to Michael Hashizume says, I love the complete throwaway sight gag in this episode when Burns is shouting, "You call this a supercomputer?" and beating a machine with a crowbar. He's hitting a Cray 1, a supercomputer from the 70s. You can see R-A-Y in text wrapped around it a bit. They're only being coy about it. Side note, I've seen a Cray 1 at Seattle's Living Computer Museum, which is pretty much the coolest place on Earth if you have an interest in technological history. And yes, Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, computer nerds. Mm. Ken Keeler, computer nerd. David S. Cohen, like a PhD in computer science. These were the jokes these people were writing.
That's true. I didn't think about it. What a something with computers background they all had. But and to be a computer nerd in like 1990, in the mid 90s, you're like, you care a lot about vacuum tubes. And
you're also wealthy.
You were well off enough to have owned computers. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those kind of gatekeeping things that money works as. If I may rant about class here. Uh-huh. So moving on to The Day the Violence Died, Zachary Adams wrote, this might be my favorite episode of the series, and this was a great deep dive. My only regret is that, understandably, there wasn't enough time to give Jack Sheldon a little more of an explanation. His voice was all over cartoons and PSAs when I was little, and I didn't know until my 30s that he was a legit legendary jazz trumpeter, or that he had a sitcom, or that he was Merv Griffin's talk show sidekick.
Wow, he's got a great voice, and he escaped the Talking Simpsons curse, so God bless him.
Thank you, Jack Sheldon, for still living it up in Jacksonville, Florida, my old home in the same city as my brother.
So Chris Dobson says, a great episode, guys. Loved all the conversation about Lee and Kirby and Disney and iWorks. If I could use my expensive education for a moment, Henry says the note is still hearsay. That might be true if the writing was used to prove that Roger Meyers' moxie made up for his lack of talent. But since it's being introduced into evidence to establish the date, not to prove the text, it's not hearsay, and the only issue is whether the note is authenticated. And while Chester doesn't testify to directly authenticate the photo, he clearly can since he tells Bart to look for the note. So it's admissible evidence. You owe me $700. I imagine Dan Graney was like the keeper of the law knowledge in that writing room. Like, wait, here's how it would work, because all the Simpsons court trials are completely legit and would happen in real life.
They all make sense. No, I didn't realize how him knowing about the note under the glass clearly proves he would. That's enough to authenticate it.
For sure. Yeah. Good point.
The Oily Maniac says, my brother worked at a supermarket that made him wear a badge that said, service is our pleasure, no tipping, please. Which he eventually modified to say, service is our pleasure, no tipping, please.
Man, that actually pissed me off.
That angers me quite a lot.
Yeah, like to wear a pin to further dehumanize you, like, don't give me money.
Yeah, I thought that, I knew that as a joke on Futurama that the pizza box and the pilot said, don't tip the delivery boy.
Yeah.
But that's actually super shitty to make people wear that. And that feels like it comes down from like some fucking Republican jerk who owns the company, some conservative jerk who owns the company saying like, I pay them enough. And if they want to earn more, they should work harder. They don't deserve tips.
I mean, I ultimately turned against capitalism. I think I've told this story before at a GameStop. When I worked there, I helped a family for like, I don't know, half an hour. Like, oh, here's all the cables you need. And here's what a memory card is. And here are good games for your kids for Christmas. And when they're checking out, they're like, you know what? You were so helpful. Here's a $5 tip for you. We really appreciate it. And my manager's like, he can't take that. Ugh. It's like, I am a full-blown communist now. Thank you so much. It's like, and I look back at that and I'm like, how petty. How petty that person was to be like, he can't have $5. He makes that in 1 hour, sir.
That feels like such a miserable manager move. Just like, no, ever tipped me, so I'm just going to pull my card and be like, nope, you can't tip them. No.
Well, they were all very miserable, and they're probably dead now. So this is a long comment from Tad Komorowski. You might remember him from our Ren and Stimpy episode of What a Cartoon. He is an animation super brain, so he knows a lot about animation. So we'll split this comment up. I'll read the first part, and we'll talk about it, and then you can read the second part, Henry. So Iwerks' heyday was the 1930s. The Disney-Iwerks split was because Disney had confronted Celebrity Pictures distributor Pat Powers about money in 1930. Powers' response was to drop Walt and buy Iwerks off and start him up with his own studio. Also, Iwerks was selling himself as the real creator of Mickey even then. Obviously, it paid off enough to get him an MGM distribution contract, but it didn't last long. The Hays Code had nothing to do with him shutting down, as he operated for years after it. He simply fell out of favor with audiences and distributors. After the demise of his own series, Flip the Frog, Willy Whopper, and the Comic-Color cartoons, he had a long period of doing work for other studios. A few Porky Pigs for Schlesinger, and mostly Color Rhapsodies for Mintz at Columbia. Yes, so that's the first half of that comment. Thank you, Thad. I mean, if I would trust anyone with this information, it would be Thad, for sure.
And Ethan continues, Iwerks finally bottomed out in 1940 and returned to Disney, where Walt put him in charge of his specialty special effects. He stayed there the rest of his life. Your new favorite of Iwerks story, when a young Mark Kausler was at Disney Studio, he met Iwerks in an elevator. He told him he was a huge fan of Flip the Frog. Ub said, we don't really talk about that here. And for the record, Huckleberry Hound is not based on Annie Griffith. It's simply the voice Dawes Butler first did for Tex Avery, just as Julio Wolf at MGM, then as Smedley at Lance. The Wolf was a regular after Tex left, and Hanna and Barbera were the cartoon's producers. They liked the voice so much that they got it modified to something a little more genial for their first major TV star.
I was so gay. Yeah, I think it's like, well, you can't blame us for thinking that Hanna Barbera plagiarized, you know.
Yeah,
like
this was the one thing they didn't plagiarize, and even then, they still kind of plagiarized from Tex Avery.
Yeah.
Like, we like that voice.
We the only thing we got wrong was where they stole from.
Yes.
Yeah. So Andrew Bouvier says, the joke, this is about, this is for A Fish Called Selma. The joke when Troy first meets Selma at the DMV and pronounces her name Bouvier wasn't ever really a joke to me because that's how my family actually pronounces our own last name. I tend to stick with the classic French pronunciation because my job entails a lot of speaking to people on the phone, and I found it's easier for people to hear / grasp my last name when said the correct way, since it's semi-famous thanks to both Jackie O and Marge and her sisters. And Henry and I both have easy to say last names, so we don't suffer this fate.
Yeah, though my last name of Gilbert in a French pronunciation, it would be the Colbert way of saying it, which, like, Colbert, I'm glad Colbert's last name is not Gilbert, because that would have changed how everybody says my name too. That all of his family is Colbert. He was always Stephen Colbert.
Stephen Colbert, yeah.
But then back he to made French. It more famous as Colbert.
I will say, oddly enough, when I'm ordering things or when I'm telling people my first name, it's hard for them to understand. I have to fully aspirate the B in a very artificial way, like Bob. Like that, Bob. When I'm ordering at Starbucks, if I go like Bob, they'll be like, oh, Paul?
Yeah.
What? Huh?
So D-Fight, speaking of Japan, our buddy from Japan, D-Fight, writes in to say, Toys was directed by Barry Levinson, a star director with a huge hit under his belt, Rain Man, Good Morning Vietnam, which likely saved him from movie jail. He's still working, but you can tell his star has faded, and Toys was part of that. Barry Sonnenfeld, who Bob mentioned, was the then rising director of the Addams Family movies and Get Shorty, who would then make Men in Black and its sequels. He's also still working today. So it's the thing I always confuse too, Levinson and Sonnenfeld. It's tough to keep track of. So thank you for the correction, D-Fight.
It's weird. Their names are not similar except for Barry, and their work is so different, but I've forgotten right now. I've already forgotten.
Boy, how do we... Levinson needed a mnemonic device like Sonnenfeld. Oh, okay, here's one. Sonnenfeld worked for Sony Pictures on Men in Black. Sonnenfeld, Sony. Sony's writing his name.
And Levinson is the toys guy, right?
Yeah, Levinson lost money with toys, so L. Levinson.
That makes sense, and he's not working anymore, as far as I know. Don't correct me. So we're on to Futurama's Big Ball of Garbage. And Jackie Beckwith says, believe it or not, scientists recently determined that Uranus has a largely hydrogen sulfide-based atmosphere, meaning that, yes, actually, all the awful jokes are right, and Uranus does smell like ass.
That's nice. I love that bit of information. Thank you, Jackie. Alex says, I used to always watch the Ronco infomercials. My family even bought that rotisserie. Set it and forget it. Mm-hmm. The food dehydrator one was always fun to watch, or the Ginsu knives they always included with the rotisserie. The infomercial that annoyed me the most were the ones hosted by Chef, in quotes, Tony, who wasn't even a damn chef. Billy May's ones were fun too, or his rival, the Sham Wow guy, who turned out to be a wife beater or something. Like, geez. Oh yeah, yeah. That did happen with Sham Wow. I forgot that.
You're gonna love my nuts guy.
Yeah.
All right. Whoa, I'm so tired.
Ronco has Ron Popeil, no the scandals I'm aware of, and he's still with us, so we beat Billy Mays and the Sham Wow guy.
Yeah, again, go down the rabbit hole of the YouTube Ronco compilations. They're all so good, and the products are like the thing that vacuums your records when you're done listening to them. They all are, like, totally watch them and then watch Tim and Eric Cinco stuff. You will understand what they're trying to reach for there.
Whenever I watched his pasta maker one, I was like, I could make chocolate pasta. Yeah, that'd be great.
It's no pasta bear. one of the most disgusting Tim and Eric things. Please look it up.
Oh, yeah.
So, I'm sorry. Hell is other robots. I'm just thinking about pasta bear now. Shy Ranger says, so you guys were confused about the 2275 Hell Act in relation to the professor, later revealed to building robots. However, here's something that could work the two together. It's called the Fairness in Hell Act, not the Fairness in Robot Hell Act. So maybe in 2275, the act was created for adding a fiddle contest to regular hell. Then centuries later, after the professor created robots and they created their own robot heaven and hell, they copied over things from regular hell, including the Fairness Act. And you know what? I'm going to say, Shy Ranger, you're probably right. Mm-hmm. Because as we know, in the Futurama world, Jesus returned.
Yep.
I'm guessing hell is probably real if Jesus could come back to life and, you know,
if there could be a zombie Jesus, yeah. there's a real hell. And yeah, another person pointed out that the professor didn't create robots. He created interesting robots, that all the robots before him were basically annoying C-3PO types, and he made ones with a little more personality, like Bender. There were robots before the professor there. I was wrong on the Futurama history on that one. Alex Kazanis says, Dan Castellaneta's awesome and distinctive robot devil voice, at least according to the commentary on one of the episodes, is Dan doing an impression of the great Hans Conried. Conried, apart from being a crackerjack comedic radio and TV personality in the 40s and 50s, is most noted for his role as Captain Hook / Mr. Darling in Disney's Peter Pan. And the second I saw Captain Hook, I was like, yep, that's his robot devil. Like, I love that Hans Conried voice. It's the second I think of Peter Pan like that, he is easily the most memorable voice in that movie.
That's amazing, yeah. And I actually just put a video in the Slack channel that I have not heard yet. It is Hans Conried doing a Pepsi commercial. I want to see if we can hear the robot devil at all in his voice.
And now, before rejoining Annie, get your gun. Here's a word for... Just a minute, sir. You wouldn't leave while I'm talking to you, would you?
You would?
Well, it's all right. You see, this isn't really a commercial. This is a Pepsi Cola refreshment intermission. A chance to get yourself very comfortable in here.
Mm.
It's a lovely home.
Kind of sinister, but no, I can hear that. Even though he's very laid back in that performance, I can hear, like, mm-hmm. It's very nice here.
Oh, it's very nice. It's a little threatening to it, too. I like that.
Yeah.
Got a little bite to it.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah, Dan Castellaneta, I believe, on a Simpsons commentary, he was, like, known as the man of 101 voices, and he could do impressions of people you wouldn't think, like the playwright Edward Albee and things like that.
Guys like him at the top of their game in the voice acting world, like, a lot of them have just this catalog, mega dorky memory of especially radio personnels like him, Billy West, Tom Kenny, all those guys are like, oh, yeah, no, I remember this person who's been dead for 80 years. No one else does.
And Mr. Burns's lawyer is in appearance, he is supposed to be Roy Cohn, mm-hmm. but his voice is actually a like character actor from like the 40s or something. Like it's on an ancient commentary, but it's like it's weird the things that people like, you know, Maurice LaMarche and Billy West and Dan Castellaneta all pull from their memory. They like smash two basically unknown voices together to create a new voice, or just pull like some obscure character actor. Like Homer's Doe was a side character in Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's weird where all these things come from. So now we're on to A Flight to Remember, the Titanic episode of Futurama. And Kevin Schiavone says, Titanic is a movie of two halves. The first being a terrible romantic period film with some neat special effects. The second half being an amazing visual effects tour de force. I remember when my sister rented the VHS tape, we discovered that not only was it two tapes, but the second tape starts right as the ship hits the iceberg. When I learned that, I made the point of watching the entire second tape. To this day, I've never seen the complete film from beginning to end, though I think I've basically seen the whole film at this point. Wow. So it's just like, choose which movie you want to see, kids.
Yeah, well, when it's a three-hour film, 90 minutes of each are a different movie, but that is the trick of it. Yeah, Red Letter Media, I think we said it on the episode too, but Red Letter Media's blanket review of Titanic really sums up pretty well how it's two movies in one, or it's kind of a trick. It's like a magic trick of a movie of like, yeah, you're seeing this sexy romantic film. Like, no, it's a big action movie.
I think that's why it was so successful. I mean, I'm not the first one to say this, but it appealed to everybody. Mm-hmm. So you got your romance and you got your murder.
It was a four quadrant hit, baby. Joe Hodgson said, I very much remember the nude scene from Titanic. What 14-year-old wouldn't who never expected to see full frontal in PG-13 film? I remember being at a Circuit City, RIP, not long after the home video release, and the store display for some televisions was playing this film. While my mom was off looking at something else, I fast-forwarded the film to the nude scene part, expecting it to be edited out, and lo and behold, it was not. So I did the only reasonable thing I could do. I paused it and walked away. I probably walked away cackling maniacally like Professor Chaos for exposing the patrons of the store to the luridness of Kate Winslet's boobies.
Yes, I used to love, I never did them myself, but I would love entertainment store pranks like making naughty screensavers and with whatever you want scrolling across them.
They just have these open computers. You can do whatever you want on them there. Mm-hmm.
So this is all about Mars University, the Futurama episode, and Christopher McDougall says, the river rafting sequence refers to the 80s movie Up the Creek, which I watched way too much in syndication as a kid. Everything from a collegiate boat race to the rivals being Ivy League snoots comes from there, and I had no idea, and I imagine they might have been pulled from this because of just how many of those slobs versus snobs, college campus comedies. It wasn't just Animal House. That was sort of the one that kind of made the mold for everything else, like including Revenge of the Nerds and later movies like that.
And if you'd watch R-rated sex romps like that in the 80s, which I and you couldn't, you'd probably remember them a lot more now. Like that would be like us now telling high schoolers like, no, you don't remember Judd Apatow made 800 films. You just haven't heard of any of them. It'd probably be on that same level. Andrew Bouvier, or no, I guess he is Bouvier. That's
yep.
says, since no one else did, I'll do my best to explain the Witten's dog gag on the chalkboard. Thank you for taking this on, Andrew. The name is a play on Schrodinger's cat thought experiment, but from quantum mechanics. Edward Witten is a modern quantum physicist, so it was just the writers joking that hundreds of years from now, he'll be as popular / more popular than Schrodinger, and will have devised his own thought experiment using a dog instead of a cat. He also did work with supersymmetric string theory, hence the other joke on the chalkboard with Farnsworth writing super duper symmetric string theory. And honestly, I'm not going to read the rest of it. Andrew goes even deeper into the science in the comment on it there. You can check it out.
I thank him so much for doing that. But man, you can tell that like, we're getting away with something by putting the nerdiest math joke ever.
Yes, yeah.
Our sci-fi like monkey throwing poop comedy.
I like they got away. Yeah, in the same episode that involves Robot House and Fatbot and a monkey throwing his filth, they also have a expert pun on Schrodinger's cat. But back in 1999, I'd certainly never heard of Schrodinger's cat. It wasn't in a movie like The Prestige that taught me about it.
Ah, okay. I never saw that.
It's a good movie.
I just knew it was about a possible cat death.
Yes.
That box. So Andrew T says, to be Mr. Jewish nitpick man, Hillel is a Jewish campus organization present at most colleges, not a college itself. Bob may have been thinking of Yeshiva University. But they put the she in Yeshiva. I just couldn't go on knowing someone was slightly wrong on the internet. Thank you. And if you've been in Hillel, let me know. Do they party down? I need to know.
Doesn't sound like they do, according to those robots. Mm. We lastly have Futurama's When Aliens Attack and Shy Ranger Shearer says, Omicron Persei 8 is a reference to the actual star system, Omicron Persei, which is indeed about 1,000 light years away from us. If you ever look up the constellation Perseus, look for three stars near each other. That's it. Take a look, and hopefully they don't invade our planet. That's why they didn't just make up Omicron Persei 8. They picked a thing that was literally 1,000 light years away that would then receive a 1,000-year-old TV show.
But what if aliens attack in 1,000 years after Roseanne gets canceled?
They're going to be pretty mad at us then. Well, I would think the first thing would happen, no, would happen 950 years from now or 930 years from now. And like, there was also a plot point. Somebody else had Ed's comment that this is kind of a plot point taken from the movie Contact, which was about them receiving the first radio waves. And it was Hitler because the first person to broadcast it, the Nazis. So man, we're talking too much about Nazis on this.
Sorry. I mean, they're super relevant now, but thank you so much. I mean, we don't say it anymore because it just gets kind of repetitive, but every month is like such a huge month for us. And we get all these new opportunities. We're doing so many more cool things. Again, I do want to repeat, Talking Futurama is temporarily over. I mean, that's just how our miniseries work, and we explain it on the last episode of the series.
The season finale is this week, yes.
But we are very, very incredibly close to unlocking a second miniseries for this year, and when that happens, it'll start in the fall. So between that, we're going to be having a lot of specials, interviews, a lot of bonus stuff. So the bonus stuff is not going away. You're still going to get a lot of extra Patreon content, but taking a break allows us to do things like do our live show and go on a trip and do other stuff that does not involve planning a very production intensive podcast. But yeah, we're taking advantage of that free time.
Three podcasts a week is a lot. We handled it. I think we did a good job with it, but I am looking forward to having two podcasts a week to plan. And also I think maybe you listeners have noticed too, like our shows have become, we're trying to get as many like a wide range of guests as possible too. And that does take a little more work than just, you know, me and Bob could just record things all the time together without having to worry about a guest like we did today. But we want to have more guests and expand like our audience and also introduce you guys to folks. Maybe some of you listeners have never heard of Chapo Trap House before, or We Hate Movies, or Super Eye Patch Wolf. And I hope that we can keep introducing you guys to some of that stuff.
And Henry named three white male guests. Well, I promise it's going to be Girls Town from here on out. We're living in Girls Town. Watch your P's and Q's, everybody.
we can't reveal this one. We tweeted it out earlier, but the artist who did the art on the Patreon, Nina Matsumoto, we recorded a episode with her, and so you're going to hear that in the future. There's everything's coming up. Simpsons podcast, we're doing a crossover with that. We are really trying to expand ourselves in general with that, so you can look forward to that even in the post Futurama break time. And we have some really cool What a Cartoon episodes coming up too.
So much fun. So thanks again for supporting us. Thank you so much for supporting the show, and we'll see you next month for another episode of Talk to the Audience. We'll see you then.
Infotainment.